Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Mike Florio can be found on Twitter at Pro Football Talk. He is Pro Football Talk and also works for NBC Sports, and he joins the Bernstein and McKnight show now. Hello again, Mike. How are you?
Hey, doing great. How are you guys today?
We're good. Do we know the substance for which Julian Edelman tested positive yet?
We don't. And I think that somebody unleashed what is a brilliant PR strategy by putting that out there, that he tested positive for an unrecognized substance, because it created the impression that maybe there's no PED at all. But I studied the PED policy, and let me just give you the shortest possible thumbnail version. Even if it's not a recognized substance, the positive test doesn't get finalized unless they believe that the unrecognized substance nevertheless has the same chemical structure and produces the same effects as one of the 71 specifically listed anabolic agents in the PED policy. So even though they didn't recognize it, they recognized enough to conclude that this thing acts the same way an anabolic agent does, and therefore it's a positive result. So it was great because it worked on me. I'm thinking, well, okay, maybe this guy has something, and maybe he can beat this on appeal. I don't think that's going to be the case. They just haven't pigeonholed it in one of the 71 specific categories. It still has something about it that makes it close enough to an anabolic agent to result in the four-game suspension.
If this thing is an outlier as far as the testing policy is concerned, or the testing, the net is concerned, is there a possibility that there are other, you know, cocktails of drugs that guys are getting into? Are we? Is it possible that we're on the edge of some new finding and in a test, well, new stuff the players are using?
They always try to stay ahead, the guys who are inclined to cheat. Now, I don't know that any guys are inclined to cheat, because everybody who gets caught, right? Well, I got a supplement and there was something in it that I didn't know about. Nope, they've never caught a cheater. They only catch the guys who accidentally ingest something they shouldn't. But I think that this is just an example of the reality that there may be other substances that aren't named in the policy, but they can tell. And I don't know, I have no idea how they even begin to determine the similarities of the chemical structure. This is probably high-level scientific analysis, breaking it down to the molecular level, but they can spot in that substance enough to know that it is something that operates the same way that one of the 71 listed substances operates. But I'm sure guys are always looking, and chemistry is always working toward finding something that can't be detected, and the NFL's testing procedure sensitive enough to at least flag a substance. Even if they can't name it, they know that it's close enough to one of the banned substances that it triggers the four-game suspension.
It's about context here too, though, right? Because of the presence of Alex Guerrero, because of the conflict that's been going on at the practice facility in Foxborough and down the road at Guerrero's clinic, with some of the weirdness of the TB12 stuff and the pliability quackery, you just start to wonder, because there's other layers here of where the team didn't even really know, and most teams really don't know, where guys are getting various things they ingest.
Oh, absolutely. And look, I don't know. Maybe this is something Edelman has been using for years, and the science on the back end has finally caught up to it, where they're at least able to tell that there's something in there that isn't one of the things they specifically test for, but they were able to crack the code. So it's a game of cat and mouse, and it's never ending because the stakes are too high. Once you get to a point where you're making significant NFL money, you're getting older, younger and cheaper guys are in a position to take your job, and you've got Bill Belichick, who makes that dispassionate, detached assessment about every player every year. Is this guy worth it? Coming off of a torn ACL, what's Julian Edelman going to do? Who's going to pay him anything close to what the Patriots pay him to play football? It's very easy to justify doing whatever you have to do to get yourself in a position, not where you can just play, but you play at a high level.
Speaking of the detached Bill Belichick, you got a piece on Pro Football Talk Now, Mike, that details a couple of things about Rob Gronkowski. What do we know? What don't we know? What was noise and what might be tangible going forward?
Well, we got to spin it back to the immediate aftermath of Super Bowl 52 when he was asked about rumors that he may retire. And he said, I don't know how you heard about that, which confirmed that it was something he was thinking about. And I believe if they'd have won that game, he would have walked away. But he spent 2 or 3 months thinking about what he was going to do. 2 days before the draft, he announced that he would be returning for 2018, and he let his head coach, Bill Belichick, know about it. I'm told that as recently as 3 days before the draft, the Patriots were calling other teams about a potential Rob Gronkowski trade. Now, I do not believe it got to the point where there was a trade on the table that Belichick wanted to accept and that Tom Brady came in and made a power play saying, I'm going to retire if you trade Gronkowski, prompting the owner, Robert Kraft, to put the kibosh on the whole thing. I don't believe that, and I've tracked that down from several different angles. But I do believe that the Patriots were exploring their options because they didn't have a commitment from Gronkowski that he was going to return. So, like every team does with some, many, maybe all of its assets. You know, there are some teams out there that I think everybody on the roster is available in trade. We've gone through periods with the Raiders back before they kind of found their way with Derek Carr and Khalil Mack, where every year at the trade deadline, they were calling teams basically saying, hey, is there anyone on the roster that you want? So it's one thing to make phone calls and inquire. It's another thing to actually get the trade into a position where it could happen, and I don't think it ever got close because I don't think there was ever a conversation with Gronkowski about what he would want financially from a new team, whether he'd show up. Because remember, February, March, April, we didn't know if he was going to show up. We didn't know if he was going to play. I don't think it ever got close enough that there were conversations like that.
I understand completely if the answer to this question is Terrell Owens is weird. But why is Terrell Owens being weird about his Hall of Fame induction ceremony?
Well, look, I think that there are a couple of potential explanations. One thing I heard in the immediate aftermath of his decision not to show up was that there's a very good chance that none of the teams he played for is willing to underwrite the cost of his Hall of Fame party. So he's kind of on his own, and you're talking about an expensive proposition. Last year, Jerry Jones had a very lavish affair with Justin Timberlake performing. And if no team is going to pay for it because he basically disintegrated every bridge back to every team he played for, then I would understand why they wouldn't want to do that. But I think at a deeper level, and this has been there because he didn't show up for the things that we see happen right after he got in. He didn't show up for the NFL honors ceremony that night. He didn't show up at the Super Bowl the next day with all the other new inductees. I think that he is miffed, not because he had to wait 2 tries to get in and got in on try number 3. I think it's the length to which some of the voters went to justify not putting him in. I mean, it would have been easy to say, look, there's a waiting line. There's a pecking order. Marvin Harrison got in before Terrell Owens, not because Marvin Harrison is quote-unquote better than T.O., but because he was waiting longer. And Terrell Owens waits, and he eventually gets in. But so many of the voters were just over the top ripping this guy. It just, I remember coming to the conclusion, why are they even considering him?
Like, see, that's the thing. I would ask, then why not just decline the honor? It's one thing to say, I'm not going to go to the induction. If you really want to be a badass about it, you say, I don't need your damn Hall of Fame at this point.
Well, you know, that's not a bad point, but I think that he understands, even T.O. understands, there is value to having a bronze likeness of yourself that is put in this giant room that is going to continue to expand and expand and expand. And, you know, I mean, it won't be our problem, but, I mean, this thing eventually is going to have, what, 10,000 busts in it. But, you know, at least for now, it's a fairly small group, and T.O. isn't going to turn down the chance to have his bust in there. But I think that at a certain level, it's kind of like, hey, if you don't want me, I don't want you. And I don't want to come and act like everything's fine when I know that there are Hall of Famers who were campaigning to keep me out and voters who didn't want me in. I'm not going to act like everything's okay. And I like the fact that T.O. is being true to himself.
Mike, we had a holdout in Atlanta with one of the best players in the NFL. And I wonder, you know, because of where he is in his contract status and because of where the next CBA kind of comes around, I wonder if you think that we may see over the next couple of OTAs, a couple of training camps, this one and the next perhaps, more players doing this to get immediate money, worried about potentially the long-term future of their status, of the communication between the union and the league.
I think it's more about just striking while the iron's hot. And when you look at the uptick that we've seen in recent months, especially at the quarterback position, and I think the trigger for Julio Jones wasn't that he's number eight among all receivers. I think it's that he's at $14.25 million and Matt Ryan's at $30 million. And Julio Jones looks at that and says, wait a minute. Something's wrong with this picture here. And he's sending a message. He's taking a stand. It's relatively inexpensive, although $84,435 is nothing to sneeze at. That's what he and anyone else who skips the three-day mandatory minicamp will lose if they enforce the fines. Now, if guys are going to give up $40,000 a day to miss training camp, that takes it to another level. But you've got guys throughout the league who are choosing to take this stand, and I think it's just an acknowledgement, maybe more of what they now know about health and safety. There's only so many years you can do this. There's only so many chances you have to get paid. And I think agents need to avoid these ultra-long-term deals. They're talking about a six-year extension for Zach Martin, the Cowboys guard. He's got 1 year left on his current deal. You really want to commit for 7 years? Aaron Rodgers committed for 7 years back in 2013. I think one of the reasons he doesn't complain about his contract more than he does, and he doesn't complain much, he's a big boy. He's a smart guy. He went to Cal. He signed his name on the dotted line in 2013 of a deal that commits him through 2019. Why are guys doing that? And now that we see Kirk Cousins with only a three-year deal in Minnesota, I think some of the great players out there are realizing, you know what, it's better to do short-term deals. It's better to keep going back to the trough and get another deal. And I think that's the impetus for a lot of this. Guys taking a stand because they know they got one, maybe two opportunities in their careers to really get paid.
Andrew Luck reportedly threw a football. And then I look at the details of the story and the information that's coming out. It's not all good, and it got a little strange because it's not just him throwing an NFL football, is it?
No, and it's Andrew Luck at minicamp practice yesterday throwing a high school ball with the white stripes on it and a small, not a college ball, but a high school sized ball. And he said he had a bit of a mental block when it came to throwing the regulation football. Look, if you're a golfer and you have a mental block with your six iron, you use the seven or the five, right? If you have a mental block with the NFL regulation football and you're an NFL quarterback, that's a problem. And it's amazing to me the lengths to which the organization has gone over the last year and a half to prop this up and be optimistic and downplay any issues, and now Luck's in on it too. And I'm not going to believe anything anyone says until we see the guy back based upon what happened last year. And I think that there's good reason to look at every development and find that. And I hate to say, oh, you're so negative, but my God, they whether they did it deliberately or not, they lied to us for an entire year about this guy's status. And now he's talking about having a mental block when it comes to throwing a football, and he's still not at practice throwing a regulation football, and they act like everything's going to be fine magically at some point in the next 6 weeks. I'll believe it when I see it, and until then, I'm not going to put any stock in anything Luck, Frank Reich, Chris Ballard, Jim Irsay says about the situation.
You mentioned long-term deals and what they do to teams. I know Luck's not, I think it's $23 million a season for Luck, and that's not exactly Matt Ryan money or anything, but I that's got to play into, if it's delusion, some of the delusion that the Colts are operating with.
Well, because there's nothing they can really do because of the injury guarantees until after this year. I'm going to pull up the contract right now. The out would be after this year, and he would have made $75 million over 3 years, but they would avoid next year, looks like about $21 million. They got to make a decision, I assume, early 2019, March 2019. So if he doesn't play this year, if he's not the guy that he once was, I think the Colts have a very, very tough decision to make. But financially for this year, it's a no-brainer. They're paying him one way or the other, so you keep him around and you see what he can do.
Mike, thank you. We'll talk next week.
All right, see you guys.
That is Mike Florio of Pro Football Talk, brought to you by Fogo de Chão. Savor authentic Brazilian steakhouse flavors at Fogo de Chão, even on a busy schedule during weekday lunch. Visit a location in Chicago, Rosemont, or Naperville for lunch, starting at $15. There was a little national basketball news yesterday, and it was Shams Charania. Shams Charania, who broke the news that the Bulls would be likely to match a max offer sheet to Zach LaVine. And he brought this up also in the context of Aaron Gordon and saying these guys very similar, you know, young, athletic, rangy, incomplete players, but both teams feel that they, in his words, in Chernia's words, the investment had already been made. Now, I want to get into that a little bit because I don't necessarily agree.
Yeah.
I don't agree with the logic, and I don't understand why the Bulls would feel that they would have to match a max offer. And we estimated the max offer. We don't know the salary cap yet,
right?
But it's probably around $25 million for that first year. If you're looking at a quarter of what the cap would be, probably give or take there, that's what we're looking at. And I would say no to a max. I would entertain a contract discussion with Zach LaVine, but I would say no to that kind of commitment to that player right now for this team.
Yeah, I know you wrote about it some for the website, 670thescore.com, and it's less about the actual money attached than it is about the process by which you're going to get there.
Right.
By which you're going to convince yourself that whether it's Zach LaVine or Andrew Luck or these players, Miguel Cabrera, with what they're worth, what you've paid them, and now what you have to commit after giving them that giant contract. So we'll get into that situation with the Bulls next. He's Dan Bernstein. I'm Connor McKnight. 670 The Score.
Nothing John Paxson said during or after the season sounded like they were ready to make a hard commitment to this Zach LaVine. However, it all gets back to the context of the trade. And here's what I hope they're not doing, that they're not retroactively trying to ensure that they don't be, that they're not seen as losing that trade. Because forget it. You made the trade. It's probably a good trade. You have what you've described as a foundational piece in Lauri Markkanen, even if maybe you didn't think it when you drafted him, but you love that guy. And Chris Dunn showed some signs, even if they're kind of needling him now about his work ethic. I didn't like what I saw in Zach LaVine's game, and I understand he was on a minute limit. I understand he's coming back from a knee injury. I totally get that. I want to give him every benefit of the doubt. But I also saw a guy who had no concept of what he was doing with his teammates, that everything was a contested long two, a my-turn possession with complete defensive confusion, and that's the last thing you want in today's NBA.
But we've seen some of this before, right? Where teams make commitments, whether it's to players they trade for, whether it's to franchise-altering moves that they make, or whether it's just to a draft pick they picked up in a second round that has turned out fairly well, you can, and it's not one front office, it's not even one sport. Hell, I mean, we talk a lot about draft picks in Major League Baseball and how much you're more willing to hang on to the guys that you picked as opposed to the guys that the last front office picked. I mean, it would make sense to understand that ego is in play here, because you don't get to that level without understanding that you make the picks. I understand what players are good here, what players are going to work, and what process this is going to be, and get involved and interested and invested in those guys. That said, we were just talking with Mike Florio, right? And granted, Andrew Luck's situation is a lot different. Well, with injury and that, well, maybe it's maybe not all that different, but injury that has affected the trajectory of one of the highest rated quarterback prospects in the last handful of drafts, right? The idea that you've got to commit X to franchise-type player, but you invent the franchise-type player instead of actually having that merited out on the court or on the field or on the dime. I mean, that's you have invested now, potentially, if you're a franchise that's going to make this max contract offer or you know the 10-year, $300 million deal, you've invested that, and now you're just stuck down this path, down this road. I mean, this is a hard cap league.
You have the opportunity to let somebody else set the market for you, too. This gets back to the Bears and Kyle Fuller and some of these other things, these opportunities. This might just be they're trying to jawbone the market down a little bit. Maybe if you put it out there, with Shams Charania that you're going to match, and
we'll take whatever it is that you're offering.
Whatever it is, we're going to match. They don't even bother with something like that,
especially with so few teams actually having money to spend.
Right? Does somebody then want to force your hand? I'm not sure the market is there for Zach LaVine to get a max. I've got a lot of huge questions about how he's going to fit on a really good Fred Hoiberg team. I don't know what he does.
We talked with Mark Deeks a lot. And you remember, we were out at Buffalo Wings and Rings for the home opener of the White Sox. Talk with Mark Deeks. That's how long ago this was. And Deeks was, and I think this opened both of our eyes, was totally ready to just out of hand have the Bulls let Zach LaVine go if they felt he didn't fit in. Where that's not at all the mindset that we had the entire season. That because he was part of a trade that altered the franchise, he was part of trade that changed the road that they were on, that he'd have to be the guy that gets invested in because of where he's at in his contract deal, where he's at in his team control.
We've got a Joe Ostrowski update and back to this conversation. So whether that sounds like $25 million max contract worth of faith, it doesn't, you don't really get that vibe from John Paxson there. And a good point for the 708, when they say we have so much invested in him, it's the sunk cost fallacy in action. It's like when you go to a movie and the movie's horrible.
Yeah.
And you say, I paid for this ticket. I'm going to watch the movie. No.
Stick this out.
At any point, you do what is best for you because you're not getting the money back.
I just, constructing that roster and draft aside, you know, this is where you kind of get down to this, the pick that they ended up getting, the fact that it's not 1, 2, or 3 and that it is 7. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is... You had to shore yourself up to a certain degree against the possibility that any one of these guys, Markkanen, Levine, or Dunn, any one of those guys didn't turn out. That's great that you got Markkanen to play at a level that, an all-star type level, a level where you could see him being a 1, 2, or 3, one of those top guys on a contender. Possible. You could see that from here.
Yeah.
Dunn has played better, right? Still some issues, still some questions, but better. The fact that the three of them didn't combine, the fact that the three of them didn't play a whole hell of a lot of minutes this last season, and when they did, it looked clunky at best, that's a problem. But the draft pick, the fact that this plan last season was to get a higher asset in this incoming draft, that didn't come through for you. That was too inoculated against any one of those three things not happening.
The tank failed. The let's call it what it is. They blew it. They won too many games.
And, I don't know if you're sitting there with – honestly, though, if you're sitting there with the second overall pick in the NBA draft, the third overall pick in the NBA draft, are you looking at the calculus for Zach LaVine any differently?
Not really.
I'm
judging LaVine on what I've seen from his game, even if I'm awaiting Marvin Bagley or Luka Doncic. Because I'm pretty sure Ayton's going first.
Yeah, it kind of sounds that way. Right? It's pretty much wrapped up.
So was the tank? You've been the one that's saying there's not the top end guy. You've been saying there's no game changing player. So how did the tank? I mean, I understand they aren't as high.
Right, because you didn't know it then.
Okay,
right.
We know it now.
Right.
Okay, but the thing is, like everybody's saying, this year was a failure because of that. They still need pieces for this team. I mean, yeah, it'll probably end up making them slightly better next year.
Yes, but going into this year, we thought this was a rare opportunity to get the best player on a champion. And now after watching everybody play, we're not as sure that any one of these guys is that.
And mind you, I am the furthest thing from a Bulls shill, but not all that's on the Bulls and the way they played. It's on the players in college that just, with the extra info.
All those things happened. But I don't think the Bulls started prioritizing winning because they were at the time recognizing. It wasn't motivating any of this.
We're all Bamba fella. I don't know. He just doesn't seem like the kind of friend. Maybe we just win a few more games.
Because we even saw in their behavior at the end of the year, we have to see what we have in our young players,
right?
Which was their way of saying, even the commissioner's on the phone with them saying, why is Robin Lopez sitting the whole game? So they were trying because you have to.
Yeah,
it's more valuable asset.
Rick got a point. They may, because of the overall talent in the draft or perhaps lack thereof, I guess, from where
depth,
we sit
though.
Now.
Like you can get two rotation players easy, probably a starter at 7 on, let's say if you want to even go higher than your next playoff team. Your next team that wins a round, you could very feasibly get a starter and another rotation wing because it's, at least from what most experts are saying, the 20s is where there's depth in wings to just get a rotation guy. You can get that in this draft, and while you're not getting the guy, the thing is, to me, that's still a good outcome.
Yeah, maybe you get Kyle Kuzma of this year's draft.
Yeah, if Wendell Carter, everybody's saying Al Horford, if he even comes close to being Horford...
Great.
I'm just saying that, that's the high-end comp. If he even comes close to his high-end comp and you get a guy that can be a backup wing that can be closer to a 3-and-D-ish guy, then I think that's a good offseason.
Or if you project Mo Bamba's body. If you say you get it Mo Bamba maximizing his frame, you're talking about a potential game-changing rim protector.
Right, because
all of that is getting away with one. You got away with one then. if that's the case, if you're picking up that dude at seven, or if you're making it work because that's getting away with one. The process you set out to accomplish when you started the season did not work the way you'd planned. Yeah, it didn't work the best that you could have made it work.
Some of that's NBA basketball.
That's true.
It really is.
This draft is better than next year, so it's not like it's, oh, they should have gone for it one more year and then go for next year. This is supposed to be the good draft. Next year's draft is worse.
I mean, lucking into Derrick Rose or having the Portland Trailblazers take Sam Bowie. I mean,
or Greg Oden.
Yeah, it happens. When you say sometimes things work out, you spin the wheel enough times, you make your own luck after a while. And I'm not going to take away from a front office that has been drafting for the most part in the high 20s, and you're taking Jimmy Butler at 30.
And making things work there.
Right.
Yeah. All right. I understand it. And if depth is the saving grace of picking where you're picking, so be it. I guess overall, I just don't know that the pick itself changes the calculus on LaVine. I mean, that decision's got to be made from that standpoint and that standpoint alone, right?
I guess there's... You don't win with depth in the NBA. I mean, I don't...
Not necessarily, no.
I don't really buy any of that. You win with great players playing at the best of their abilities. But if they are trying to accelerate a rebuild, if you can maintain a level of talent and flexibility, it does give you an opportunity to be a reasonable destination for free agents and perhaps viable in the trade market when guys become available. So
that's how teams, you have to give yourself multiple avenues to get that guy. That's what Houston did. Houston was able to trade a bunch of their guys to get Chris Paul. Mind you, there's other circumstances around that. Mm-hmm. That's how they were able to get James Harden. Look at Toronto. There's thoughts that they were able to compete and also build on the fly, and now they're thinking of maybe cashing some of those guys in to get another dude. I mean, that's, you can't just say, well, we're not getting the star, so screw it all. Like, that just seems like that's what most people want.
As part of this conversation, as only he can, Connor McKnight also invoked the names of Andrew Luck and Miguel Cabrera's name came up. And
yes,
that is somebody we wanted to get to who has suffered at least a season-ending injury. And I was just wondering that if in fact that's it, this is a guy walking among some baseball giants right now already, if he never plays another game. I want to get into the numbers a little bit with him, see where he stands historically. Not Harry, he stands historically. That's different.
No, he does stand historically.
He does. But sort of see where he fits and what those numbers are, and also look at those contract details, because
his legacy is more than just some of the numbers he's put together, too. I mean, it really is. When you look at how that contract and that man and that team and that city got itself to the point it's in now, his legacy is a little bit wider than just the numbers.
Okay, we've got the Midday Midway at 11. Nick Boynton is going to join us at 11:40. Len Casper at noon. And keep it here, because we're going to give away a pair of tickets to our first Cubs On Deck luncheon of the season. That's going to be Monday with Javi Baez and Ian Happ at the Budweiser Brickhouse Tavern. And tickets are on sale now at 670thescore.com/ondeck. Brought to you by AZEK Building Products and Xfinity. We're Bernstein and McKnight. You got the score. This segment is brought to you by Indeed. Are you hiring? With Indeed, you can post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates in an online dashboard. Get started at Indeed.com/hire. Miguel Cabrera has had quite the baseball life. And Cubs fans remember him as a wiry 20-year-old in 2003 and already affecting games. He only played in 87 games, but you knew it was a thing when you saw it early.
Oh, man. Supreme amount of talent, and a guy that a lot of scouts. Yeah, I mean, you hear the scouting comps and stuff when kids come up through the international ranks and get signed and things, but Hall of Fame was thrown around for that kid when he was like 18.
He's got a career slash line of .316, .395, .551. That's a lifetime OPS of .946 and a career OPS plus of .151. So he's half again better as a hitter than average.
He's a Hall of Famer. He's a first ballot Hall of Famer.
And if you start looking at some of those numbers and the predictors they have, you know, black ink, gray ink, Hall of Fame monitor, Hall of Fame standards. I like JAWS. That is the Jay Jaffe single number that uses career wins above replacement and what the peak war was to make those into a career versus how great were you at your greatest.
It's a 7-year peak that he uses, right? That's that JAWS?
Yes. Yeah. The average Hall of Fame first baseman, there are 21 first basemen in the Hall of Fame. The average has 66.8 career war, 42.7 7-year peak, and so a JAWS of 54.7. Cabrera is 69.3, 44.7, and a 57. So well above average lines in all of those numbers, putting him in an elite company.
Plus, and, you know, I don't necessarily care whether you're first ballot or second ballot. That, I mean, that gets it gets convoluted in some of the ways we get votes to begin with is pretty crazy. But the guy has a triple crown as well. That's going to get him a ton of votes, whether it should or shouldn't.
Yeah,
that's beside the point. But the guy's going in. It is. It's over and done with.
Similar batters through age 34.
Oh, yeah, yeah, absolutely.
This is through his age. At just age 34, your similars 10-1. Stan Musial, Al Kaline, Vlad Guerrero, Willie Mays, Ken Griffey, Manny Ramirez, Mel Ott, Hank Aaron, Frank Robinson, and Albert Pujols.
Yep. Done, 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 and done.
Yep. And for his whole career, the whole shape of his career, if right now it's over, Carlos Delgado, Billy Williams, Fred McGriff, Willie Stargell, Frank Thomas, Jeff Bagwell, Todd Helton, Chipper Jones, Manny Ramirez, Vladimir Guerrero, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 asterisks denoting 6 Hall of Famers of those 10 comps.
His career may not be over. His contract certainly won't be over. The guy is signed through mutual options through the 2024 and 2025 seasons at $30 million a clip. Everybody knew that the contract he signed was going to look like this at some point. Just weren't sure exactly where that point would be. And I guess, you know, looking back at those Tiger teams, I've got the 2012 Tigers. I just pulled them up because that's Prince Fielder. It's Miguel Cabrera, of course. That's, you know, pitching staffs that look like Verlander and Scherzer and Pfister.
Was Kinsler there yet?
Anibal Sanchez. No, Kinsler was just a couple years after that, I think, right. 2 years after. But they never had – long story short is that Tigers team pushed all in because Mike Ilitch wanted to win a title he was alive. And I can't blame him for that at all. They never filled out a bullpen. That was always kind of a downfall for them. There was Benoit or Valverde. They had Octavio Dotel in there for a little while. Phil Coquette a year and a half. But that's, you know, the bullpen names you got to run through.
Wasn't Joaquin Benoit the one that had the Guitar Hero injury at the time?
No, that was Joel Zumaya.
Joel Zumaya, who
was shaped like Rondon.
Yes.
This is Joe, who they also had, but he couldn't get him to throw strikes. There's a push in, right? There's an all in the middle that is somewhat, well, that is admirable. I mean, it is. They threw the money at it to go in and never got it done. That said, you know, I don't mean to shout and yell into the darkness about the need for a redistribution of wealth every day, but sometimes I do.
Yeah, you take a day off every now and then.
Sometimes I take a day off, but I just can't help but think, you know, whether it's the Tigers, whether it's even baseball or otherwise. There's no better way to do it, maybe, or there's no better way to transition from how we pay players now for past performance. That really the only thing you can do, because predicting future performance is, I mean, that's the golden bullet, right? I mean, that's the golden gun. You get that thing done, and you had that in a front office, you would never
magic
be wrong.
Bullet?
Magic bullet, golden gun. I was playing James Bond for 64 in my head and just thinking of Scaramanga, right?
Yes.
Isn't that the golden gun
Scaramanga.
Guy? Scaramanga. Oh, which one is, what Bond is that?
Isn't it the man with the golden gun?
Yeah, that makes sense. That would make sense. The man with the golden gun.
Pretty sure that's what it's literally called.
Of course it is. It's the man with the golden gun. Odd job in that? No, not odd job.
No, that's Goldfinger.
The little guy. Right, there's Scaramanga, and then he's got the little friend that helps on the island, and he's from.
Are you confusing this with Fantasy Island?
No, isn't there
Connor from Niles over here?
Maybe, I don't know. I don't know.
Francisco, is this also while in a parking lot in Rocky?
Hold on. Francisco Scaramanga
is
the fictional character, the main antagonist in the James Bond novel and film versions of
The Man with the Golden Gun.
Scaramanga's signature weapon is
it's a golden gun.
It is a golden gun. Correct.
Right. So And go on, the other villains in that?
This only says Scaramanga. So I don't know who his little friend is. Henchman. Oh, is it Knick-Knack?
Yes. Thank you.
Okay.
Is he a doctor of sax?
I don't know.
Knick-Knack, played by Hervé. I can't pronounce
Hervé
his last name.
Yes.
Okay. So.
So it is. He also played the.
Don't sound so crazy now, do I, you bastard?
Now who's holding the golden gun?
All of you.
Yes, Hervé Villechaize was Knick-Knack, and he also played Tattoo,
yes,
who was Mr. Rourke's sidekick.
On Fantasy Island. Right.
But he wasn't a murderous henchman there.
I don't know. I never saw Fantasy Island.
Really?
No. The reruns were not on when I was skipping school. No,
yeah, that was every Saturday night.
Christopher Lee played Scaramanga, and in Fantasy Island, it wasn't Christopher Lee. It was Roberto Montalban.
Ricardo Montalban. Roberto was his less expensive.
From whatever happened to Juan Pizarro.
That was in the rap con. They couldn't get the actual
fire,
guy.
I got the horse out of the barn. I don't know. We had spaghetti for lunch.
How old was Vince Lombardi when he died?
Ricardo Montalban was also Khan in Wrath of Khan.
Correct.
There you go.
And I was wrong about that because I assumed he had a fake chest on.
No,
Khan.
No.
And apparently, no. Ricardo Montalban was super proud of his all-natural pecs.
Very, very happy about showing up on set with those deep-cut V-neck vests.
Yeah, he was like working out with Alex Guerrero to be pliable as Khan. Where the hell are we? Oh, we're on the.
I don't know.
Cusp of the midday midway. This segment brought to you by Fogo de Chão. Savor authentic Brazilian steakhouse flavors at Fogo de Chão. Even on a busy schedule during weekday lunch, visit their location in Chicago, Rosemont, and Naperville for lunch starting at $15. I want to read, I know we alluded to it during transition, but I want to read this the report from FRS Baseball regarding an NL executive saying some things about Bryce Harper that will blow your hair back. And did you follow the raccoon yesterday?
I heard about a raccoon making his way through Twitter, but I wasn't quite sure if he was scaling Twitter or something else.
He was doing things I didn't know a raccoon could do, and now I'm a little concerned.
Reggie Bush is just a little bit richer, and he probably
ought to be.
He's
a little Richard?
He's a little bit richer.
Okay.
And there's a story about that from the Senators, the hockey team, that is a crazy one. The only way to do this is to read it. It's nuts.
Reading is good.
That's coming up in the midway on the Score.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.